that didn't work. And welcome to Execution Watch. This is Ray Hill on radio station KPFT HD2 channel. And with me is Jim Skelton in the studio. We have got an interview later in the program with Professor Dennis Longmire, who is a witness to tonight's execution and will not be available by phone, so we talked to him earlier. Gloria Ruback is joining us from Huntsville. And later on, we're going to have Nancy Bailey from the vigil here in Houston. Gloria, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, what's going on up there?
Well, Professor Longmire, that you just mentioned, just walked across the street with Richard Burr and Chris Tritico and other witnesses for the execution. Five media people walked in, and it looks as though another person's going to be murdered tonight. Another one Thursday. Although I did find out some good news, even though there's no visits being allowed in the system. This weekend, apparently, TDC made an exception, and the two people scheduled for executions this week were allowed to have visits on Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, the woman that called the prison show from in the United States from Belgium, and she was expecting Miriam this winter. No, well, Miriam wouldn't be in town yet because she's coming tomorrow. But they did allow visits with people from death row. Chances are she got to visit. That's very good news.
Well, now there's a woman from Belgium standing right here, but she didn't get to visit.
Oh, she was not allowed to visit.
No.
Is she the same one that called the radio show Friday?
I don't know. Are you the woman from Belgium that called the prison show Friday night? No, Friday night.
Friday night, it was Chantal.
Oh, it was Chantal. It was another.
Okay.
Did she get to visit? No, she didn't get her visit either.
Okay. That's very disappointing because her furlong voice helped the...
Well, and there's another gentleman here, Carl Rodenberger, is here from Germany. He's being denied his visits, and he has to leave next week. And he had, I think, two or three special visits set up.
Well, this lockdown is excruciating, and until the lockdown is over, the prison show is going to be almost all telephone calls.
Right,
and
right.
So we're going to.
No, I have. Isn't that something? I've got two foreign nationals standing right here protesting the execution because.
How many total folk you got out there?
One. There's a small crowd tonight, actually. 2, 4, 6, 7 of us. Some of the regulars could not come, and of course Dennis went inside.
Yeah, Dennis is a witness. And
right.
I interviewed him earlier, and we'll be playing that interview later on this program.
Yeah, I had suggested that to Elizabeth because he is full of information about this case that nobody except Execution Watch will be covering.
No, it's something that they have the case. It was interesting, the development of science, and I don't want to, you know, pre-alarm people about Dennis's interview, but we get into that during that interview. It was the evolution, scientific evolution as the time of this trial, national sentiments. It goes to show you how many obtuse factors figure into these trials and their consideration.
Well, it is interesting, and I'll tell you, yesterday I went to Conroe for a hearing for Larry Swearingen, who's on death row, and his attorney had put forth a motion to have the judge recused because of his chumminess with the victim's family, and I actually testified because at a hearing he had in June, the victim's family came into the courtroom from the judge's chambers and sat in the jury box. And actually, when they walked out, I didn't know who they were. I thought, oh, my God, we just sat through DACA call, and now we got to sit through a jury trial. And it turned out it wasn't a jury after all. It was just the victim's family. And then when the hearing was over, they went back into the judge's chambers and emerged about 30 minutes later. So, but you're talking about all the things that happen in these trials. The visiting judge that heard the recusal motion was, what's her first name, Rita? Corbett Townsley or Townsley Corbett.
Yeah.
And she was the judge in Anthony Graves' case. Anthony had his sentence reversed, got him, at least 2 years ago, and is still waiting on either a new trial or bail or release. And she has been horrible on his case, and she was also the judge in Rodney Reed's case, which was a murder and rape case out of Bastrop. So I don't know how she wound up in Conroe for this hearing, but maybe they just call her when they need somebody that's totally
hostile. You get a throwdown judge to suit the decision you want to come out, I suppose. Gloria, you hold her down now. If anything else happens, get in touch with Elizabeth, and we'll put you back on.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right, bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Ruback, and she was calling in from Huntsville outside the Walls unit where she is with the vigil. Folks there from Europe that have come all the way across the pond to visit people on death row, and their visits are not being allowed. With me, of course, is Jim Skelton. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Ray?
I am well. This is a different case.
Yes.
Your reflection, your... What do you think about this one?
Let me give you some background before we go into it. What had happened, there had been a birthday party at a man's house, and had a 7-year-old daughter named Nicole Benton.
Mm-hmm.
And she disappeared from the front yard, and they looked for her and looked for her and couldn't find her. And what happened, some of the neighbors suggested they talk to Eric Nino. And the reason the neighbors suggested that, because about a year earlier, a little girl had her bike broken, and... in the neighborhood, and what he did is he apparently lured her in the house and tried to pull her pants down. So he had a reputation, at least in the neighborhood, of being fond of little children.
Mm-hmm.
And since this girl was 7 years old, the neighbor said go talk to him. So what happened, 2 days after the girl disappeared, the officers show up at Nino's house and knocked and knocked. He finally went there several times. He finally came and finally answered the door. And they do what they typically oftentimes do. They tell him that he's a suspect. He's been reported to somebody that may know something about the child, and quizzed him and asked for consent to search the house, and they found nothing. He gave him consent. And then they asked him if he would mind coming down to the police command center. They had set up a trailer house about within blocks of the site. Asked him to come around the command center. And the reason they do that, everybody's familiar with the old Miranda decision, and you're familiar with what happened. But see, when Miranda and Escobedo came out, we talked about police warning suspects. When it first came out, what it said, as soon as the focus of the investigation focused on somebody, they're supposed to give them a Miranda warning. Which meant under, if it had the old decision been in effect, since the investigation focused on Nino, if the old Miranda had been in effect, they would have warned them then. But what the Berger Court and what the Rehnquist Court did, they basically gutted Miranda, and what they've now said is that for Miranda to be applicable, you've got, number one, be in custody.
Uh-huh.
And number two, you've got to be questioned while in custody. So police have taken advantage of that, and what they will do with the suspect, they'll say, looky, you know, we want to investigate this. If you'll come down, we'll get it cleared up. We're not going to arrest you. So mm-hmm. It means he comes to the police station, but he's not in custody, and therefore they don't have to Mirandize him. In fact, the people who do this a lot, especially in Bexar County, they're real good about instances where they have a suspect, and they'll go to their house and look, there's no arrest warrant issued, no nothing issued. Saying, looky, someone's accusing you of a crime. If you want to clear this up, come down and talk to us. You're not under arrest. You're free to go. You don't have to go. The person goes down there thinking they're going to try to help him. They get him to confess. Then they turn him loose and say he's not in custody. They don't arrest him. Then after he leaves, a couple of days later, they arrest him. The reason they do that, they don't have to Mirandize them.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, the Rehnquist-Berger Court pretty well gutted Miranda by just taking the date when it was applicable and moving it back. So what happened in Nino's case, they said, look, if you didn't do it, why don't you come down and take a polygraph?
They had a location in the neighborhood.
Right? Yeah. Okay. He was about 2.5 blocks from where the girl, he's about 2.5 houses down where the girl disappeared. So he goes down to the police station by himself without a lawyer. And they do the technique that's done over and over again. In fact, Hugh Ainsworth did this with Theodore Bundy. To get someone to confess about a crime, they say, what do you think the killer would have done? For what Ainsworth did with Bundy, for example, he said, look, you've known a lot about this murder since you've been the prime suspect. What do you think the murderer was thinking? And get them to talk about the murder in the third person. And they did this with Nino. They began to question him. Who do you think might have taken the girl? And Nino began to describe a person much like him. And said, why would the neighbors suspect you of taking this girl? He says, well, I think they suspect me because earlier I got arrested and got in trouble for messing around with, trying to mess around with a little girl. And then they went ahead further and asked him, he admitted, number one, fantasizing about small children, mm-hmm. looking out the window at small children, masturbating, mm-hmm. and fantasized about having a girlfriend that had small children, talking to her about sex. And then what they did is said, would you mind take a polygraph? And they, of course, all the conversation is very nice and casual, nothing. They offered him something to drink and let him have food. So he agreed to do the polygraph. So what happened, the polygraph operator comes down, and he takes about an hour. The polygraph lasted about an hour. And what happened when the polygraph test was completed, the polygraph test said nothing, just sat there silently. And, of course, Nino is dying to find out what happened. And so nothing said. They just sat there. And finally Nino says, I flunked it, didn't I? And the guy said, yes, you didn't do well. And then he said, the polygraph operator says, since you flunked it, you should tell us where the girl's body is. And he confesses.
Mm.
So he tells him at this point, after some prodding from the polygraph operator, he explains that he'd killed the girl. And what he basically told him was this, that he abducted the little girl, took her into the bathroom, into a bedroom, tried to have sex with her, but couldn't, killed her, and then had sex with her after she died. And then stuffed her body up in the attic. And so then they get a written confession from him, because obviously they can't talk about the polygraph at trial. And so once he's already blurted out verbally, they get a written confession from him, then get a consent to search his house. And then they go to his house and they find the body, DNA evidence from the bodies tied into him. They find the clothing, stuff in a closet. Found a bunch of porno books inside the closet on top of all of that. And that was back. And really, the thrust of the appeal and the thrust of the case was that his. It all springed off the confession, because without the confession, I mean, the confession led to everything. And that's why they tried to argue on direct appeal that, number one, it was coerced, but truthfully, the problem is he was never in custody when he gave the polygraph. And remember, Miranda is only applicable if you're in custody. It's only applicable if they question you while in custody. He wasn't in custody under the law. They even Mirandized him on top of that. And so the confession led to the body, which led to the DNA evidence that tied him to the body. And if the confession is there, he's dead meat. And then during the trial, like I said, the guilt or innocence is pretty foregone conclusion. And then during the trial, during the punishment phase, they had an FBI expert who specialized in the behavior of them. He studied a lot of sex crimes involving children. And of course, he did, much like Dr. Death used to testify, that this guy was a hopeless pedophile, that he'd be a danger in the future, blah, 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 and that he would likely be active again. And then they had the evidence of the little girl earlier, then another incident where he patted the girl on the bottom, and the jury gave him the death penalty rather promptly. And really, the issues on appeal, they had a, on direct appeal. They argued a lot about the expert testimony of the FBI agent, which did no good. And then they tried to argue that the confession was coerced because of the silent little deal the polygraph operator did. But that will never float, because they allow police to use trickery. They can lie to you if they want to. Yeah. And if you confess, that's what they call SOL.
This case happened in Hunkley. What county is it?
Harris County.
It's in this case?
Well, it happened here in Houston.
Yeah.
In fact, he's trying Denise Collins' court. And like I say, those were the only major issues. And what they did after that was affirmed by the, and you talk about bad luck, he drew Sharon Keller as the judge that wrote the opinion. Sharon Keller's, of course, now the chief judge. She's the one, the famous one, for closing the clerk's office to keep them from filing any type of petitions to save somebody from death row. And she's a horrible creature. And anytime she gets a case involving sex, she hadn't been laid in her lifetime, she just goes bonkers. And so Sharon Keller wrote the opinion. That was what you call bad luck. But there was a couple of concurring opinions, no dissenting opinions on the state level. And then they didn't bother to do a certiorari to the Supreme Court. They went in on the state writ, and the state writ was denied. They went in on the federal writ, and what they argued in the federal writ is basically the same thing, is that the trickery of the polygraph operator by remaining silent with subtle coercion to make him confess, but that didn't float. And they argued that point, and they argued a point back then that the state didn't provide lawyers for state writs. But they said that was a collateral attack, and they wouldn't permit that. So really the whole thing bailed upon getting rid of the confession, just no way. Because, like I say, with Miranda, once they bring you down to the police station, if you're not in custody and you talk to them, and then they... You know, he went on his own, and once he started, and like I say, they're very good about getting people to talk, because they think since they're not under arrest, they're trying to clear themselves up from it. And he's been very forthcoming about it, at least afterwards. He's never said he didn't.
Yeah, he made a statement this week that he didn't think anything could stop his execution.
No.
Now, there was an issue raised, and I don't know when it was raised, about possible service-related frontal lobe chemical injury.
I think that was... See, I couldn't... Reading the opinion, I think that was raised at trial, too, probably as a mitigating factor. Because what happened when I read the opinion, one of the things that was written about in the direct opinion was that they cross-examined a defense expert about some of his underlying data. And see, here's the problem. If you... And we've talked about this before. That cuts two ways. If a jury thinks somebody is brain dead or have a brain problem, there's no cure for that unless you elect him judge and then become a genius.
Because
the only way to cure mental retardation is elect somebody. You know, George Bush is proof of that. So,
right.
You know, and so if somebody's mentally retarded or has brain damage, that's incentive to kill them. In fact, it cuts two ways. And because see, again, you go back, it has to be a defect so great that you don't know what you did was wrong. And the problem was he obviously knew what he did was wrong because he hid the body.
Yeah, I mean, there's a trail to knowing the difference between right and wrong.
Right.
There and but is that an evolving science? This chemical damage to the brain, and I mean, what it was is he was involved in cleaning out boilers, and the chemicals used in that would have a negative effect on his frontal lobes, where his impulsive control was at risk. Is that going to be an evolving issue in these kinds of cases?
Developing that science may be evolving, but the problem is the way they're going to use it in court until it interferes with his ability to know right from wrong. As long as we keep our definition of what insanity is, it's not going to do a damn bit of good. Because see, what I find tragic about cases like this... Do we need to do an interview now, Ray?
Yeah, well, okay. I've got Nancy on the line.
Okay.
Nancy!
Hi, Ray.
Where are you?
I'm on the corner of San Jacinto and Maine, on the corner of Benz and Maine, in front of the St. Paul's Methodist Church.
How many folks are there with you?
There's four, but we got people out of town and some people in Huntsville.
You bearing signs for the passing traffic?
Yeah, and the good news is that we're getting some good honks and some good waves. And only rarely do we have anybody yell bad things at us now.
Well, if you're listening to this, Nancy Bailey is among a group of people that have a vigil in Houston every time Texas does an execution. We've already talked to Gloria in Huntsville, and everybody's filed across the street, so the process is in progress. And so Nancy and a group are here in Houston. Nancy is a board member of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and she's here helping coordinate with Amnesty International concerning Texas death trap. And Nancy, my our regards to the folks that showed up, and we may get back in touch with you whenever we hear from Gloria about the process being completed.
You want me to hang up and you make...
No. If you have any statement, if you want to add to any discussion, please feel free to do so now.
Well, I'm always ready to talk about our efforts, but if time has run out...
Well, I mean, the process is ongoing, so... But yeah, I've got you on the phone now, and the audience is listening. Now it's time to talk to them.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to mention that we're all trying to get ready for the legislative session that's starting on January the 13th. And we're trying, TCADP is trying to work with the legal community and with some other organizations that are really into legislative activities and try to put forth our abolition bill and maybe some other bills that are favorable to our movement. They're having a big meeting in Austin today. I was not able to go, but some members of National Coalition came down, and some other organizational members from other groups that are working with us are there, and they were meeting all day to work on a plan.
Is there any discussion about proceeding with a if not abolition, a moratorium alternative?
Well, there are those that feel that the climate is such in Texas that it would be possibly even harder to get a moratorium bill through than an abolition bill. I'm not sure I understand why, but that's the current thinking.
And if people want to participate in the head scratching and the discussions, how do they do that?
Well, they can get in touch with us by going through the website. We have a coordinator there who responds to everything that comes in through the website, or anybody can communicate with me. Oh, the website. I guess I should give the website address.
Please.
TCADP.org.
TCADP.
T as in Texas. TCADP, as in Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. TCADP.org. And there's a communication mechanism there. Or they can get in touch with me, and my email address is nlbailey@earthlink.net. I'll be happy to give my phone number if you want me to.
You may.
You want me to?
Go ahead, Nancy.
281-933-4925. And we'll be happy to accept help and input and participation from anybody that has some good ideas and wants to join us.
Thank you, Nancy.
Well, thank you for what you're doing, Ray.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Nancy Bailey of the Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty. And we're going to give Gloria a call and see if there's been any progress up there. Jim, is there anything else about the appeals that are outstanding this case, or this has been pretty perfunctory?
Pretty perfunctory. See, what bothers me about cases like this is that up until recently, we have had absolutely nothing by way of treatment for pedophiles. And as a matter of fact, you know, I think your Gloria's ready to call.
Yeah, Gloria's ready to call, so we'll get Gloria on. Gloria.
We're up to 419 or 418 or 420.
Gloria.
Yes.
You're on.
Okay.
What's happened?
The media just came out, so the execution has taken place. I'm waiting to see if Richard Burr was apparently one of the lawyers, and he went in and witnessed along with Dennis, so I guess they'll be coming out shortly. So they're actually right on schedule for Texas, 25 after.
25 after through. Gloria, you had the march this weekend, and health prevented me from being there. Tell us about it.
I'm sorry you missed it. It was a pretty exciting day, actually. It was not quite as big this year. We knew that we hadn't done all our work because of the hurricane, but it was still a good-sized demonstration. And what was particularly wonderful was the large number of death row families that came out this year. Oh, my gosh. There was like over a dozen families who spoke. Two different carloads came from the valley. Actually, one was a van filled with
family members of four different people on death row. And then the other car was, or maybe they had two, because there was about eight people. They were the family of Melissa Lucio, who was one of the 10 women on death row.
Mm-hmm.
She was just sent to death row in August. So that was really her sister and her mother spoke. I'm spoken, or maybe it was her grandmother in Spanish. Wonder why Dennis and them haven't come out. Anyway, so it was. You know, usually at rallies towards the end, people leave.
Yeah.
And nobody left because these families were talking, and it was just so incredibly moving what the families go through. Rudy Medrano's wife, she said, you know, we have a 7-year-old son. He was 2 when this happened. Rudy was convicted under law parties. He wasn't there. We were home that night watching a movie. She said, and when his dad was first arrested, I said, oh, don't worry, Daddy will be home soon. She said, it's 5 years later, he's 7 years old, and I don't know what to tell him.
Was there any filmmakers, anybody documenting all this? Because
I'm not sure.
You know, I really think that the enormous untold story is the story of families of death row.
Yes.
I think that has some enormous political and social import.
Absolutely.
Reasons to do that. And so it's a rare occasion where you get a large number of families together at one place. And it seems a shame that somebody isn't there making an oral history, if not a visual history of that.
There were people videotaping. Actually, KPFT has an oral history. Ernesto and Bill Crozier were out there and taped the whole thing.
They taped the whole thing and all the speakers, but interviewing the people there is a sidebar. Was there a microphone set up to do that?
That I don't know. Not doing. And Rachel Clark interviewed people.
Okay, good. So as long as some interview is being done, then what we need to do is we need to get somebody to lace that together into either a show or into a paper of some kind.
Well, and you know, I encourage your listeners to tune in to Open Journal the Friday after the election. Ernesto's going to edit the audio and put it into
you've got a scheduled date Friday after the election, Friday on November the 5th. November, that election is the 4th.
4th, 5th, 6th, 7th?
7th, November the 7th on KPFT at the noon hour.
12 noon, yeah. So that should be really, really good. Three of the people that are here tonight are here from Austin, and they're with a group. Tell me the name of your group. I'm losing. Texas After Violence Project, which is a project that deals with all kinds of people who've experienced violence, including people who are crime victims, who are
execution victims. Do you want to put one of them on and have them share their thoughts with us?
Sure. Would you like to be on the radio and tell them about your project?
Sure.
They're on live right now.
Okay. Hello, this is Virginia Raymond. I'm here outside.
Oh, Virginia, this is Ray Hill.
Ray,
yes.
Hello. Hi. I wondered if that would be you. Hi, Ray.
Hi, sister. How's it going in Austin? What are you doing?
Well, you know, I've never come to Huntsville for an execution before, so you know, it's different to be outside these walls. It's really different, and
it is. And our friend Dennis Longmire, who is usually out where you are, actually went in and witnessed the execution. And so,
yes.
The next time we have him on the air, we've got an interview later in this show of our conversation before.
Yes.
But I'm interested in his impressions of the experience.
Sure.
But what is your organization doing in Austin?
Well, actually, Ray, it's an oral history project, and thank you for letting me talk to you, because there may be people, and I want to interview you. We are an oral history project. We just started, and our purpose is to listen, mostly to listen, which, as you know me, is the change for me. but to listen to the experiences of people who have been touched in any way by the experience of capital punishment, by perhaps being a law enforcement, a police officer who responds to a tragedy, a first responder, maybe a family member of someone who is murdered, all the way to people who are family members of executed persons and people who participate in any way. We think that all of those stories need to be told, and we need to listen very carefully.
Well, strangely enough, I was just talking to Gloria about that because I thought it was perhaps a missed opportunity at the recent march here in Houston to collect those oral histories and document the appearance of so many families of death row together.
I hope we can. We're very brand new, Ray. There's two of us who are working, and then we're trying to get volunteers and some of the students from Houston Tillotson and University of Texas at Austin, and then I'm hoping to get also some St. Edward students. But we have been in existence less than a year, but we are trying to get those oral histories from anybody who will talk to us, anybody. We are trying to break down this idea of sides, the false polarization, as if people who are family members of murder victims are interests
sure.
are necessarily opposed.
The Linda White movement, and of course,
exactly.
Sister Helen Prejean, that was her concept, has
exactly.
always been her concept.
Yes.
How do people get in touch with you, Virginia?
I'm sorry?
How do people get in touch? Do you have a website?
We do have a website. Thank you for asking. It's http://www.texasafterviolence.org. Texas, just like Texas, T-E-X-A-S, after, A-F as in Fred or friend, T as in Tom, E-R, Violence, V as in Virginia, I-O-L-E-N-C as in cat, E.org, chapterviolence.org. And we would love to come listen to the stories, the experiences of anybody who has been affected in any way or participated in any way, whether as a family member of a murder victim, a police officer, an EMS person. We are also interviewing advocates and activists, and so you're on my list, Ray.
Okay, Virginia, if you find yourself over in the Houston neck of the woods on a Friday night, remember we're still doing the prison show. We don't have a show right now because with no visits, we've made a priority of making the phones available to as many people as possible.
Thank you very much for all your work. And
if you get over here at times other than Friday, don't forget we can always coffee up.
Okay.
Bye-bye, right. Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Bye.
Bye. That was Virginia Raymond of Austin, a longstanding friend and a good activist. She got a law bar card, but I don't think she uses it. I think she does use more useful things with her time than be an officer of the court. I understand we have some music coming up.
Seeking gain, all your senators and lawyers with your motives to explain, all you victims and you heroes, your petitions to complain, all your murderers and martyrs on the fields where you lay slain, on the just and unjust alike it does rain, and the quality of mercy is not strained. Yes, vengeance and revenge, they're just two words for pain, and the quality of mercy is not strained. not I crucify my Lord? Did not I bind him in chains? Did not I three times betray him? Three times deny his name? Did not I cast the first stone? Then justify the blame? Did not he die for my sins? But never would I do the same. Oh, I've been three times a sinner and two times a saint. And the quality of mercy is not strange. Yes, for love, if it's love, is changing but unchanged. And the quality of mercy is not strange. Hypocrites and liars.
The quality of mercy is not great.
Senators and lawyers.
The quality of mercy is not great.
Victims and heroes.
The quality of mercy is not great.
Murderers and martyrs.
The quality of mercy is not great.
Crucified my Lord.
The quality of mercy is not great.
Bind him in chains.
The quality of mercy is not
three times betrayed.
This is Ray Hill talking to Professor Dennis Longmire, who is in Huntsville, Texas. Dennis, you're not going to be able to report from demonstration because you've got other responsibilities tonight. What are they?
That's correct. Tonight I have the honor, I guess, it's certainly a privilege, of being asked to witness Eric Menno's execution. And so I will be participating in the execution as a witness for the condemned. You're going to hear animals and children playing. I'm outside in front of the hospitality house so that we have a little bit of privacy. Eric's two attorneys who represented him during his appeals are also going to be witnessing. They are now inside the hospitality house waiting for us to be escorted about two blocks to the actual administration unit, where we will wait until we go into the execution chamber.
Have you ever done this before?
No, this is my first, the first time I will be witnessing. I have had opportunities two times before, and fortunately, on both of those occasions, I did not have to witness.
Well, you said you did not have to witness.
Correct.
Do you anticipate, what kind of experience do you anticipate this being?
Well, the preparation that we've been given by the chaplains, there are two chaplains who provide a briefing on what to expect, describe the sterility, they describe the basic process that it looks like the person is going to sleep. So I don't expect any particular trauma around the actual killing itself. I'm not sure how I will respond to that specific aspect of it. The kind of the sanitized way that we go about killing people, I think, is going to be most troubling to me.
But you are familiar with this case on other bases, right?
Absolutely. I worked as an expert consultant, and I was going to testify during Eric Menno's trial. I worked for the attorneys that represented him during the trial. Fortunately for me, I did not have to testify. His attorneys decided that the kind of information I was going to be providing had already been provided by the state's witness, and that would concern the security of the facilities and the ability to keep someone like Eric safe from committing new crimes for an appreciably long period of time.
Were you going to testify on what the basis of his future dangerousness?
Certainly. One of the questions that the jury has to determine in all capital cases is whether or not the person, once they've been convicted of a capital crime, whether or not they present a future danger or likelihood of committing a serious crime against either someone in prison or someone on the outside, should they ever be released or escape. And so one of the areas of expertise I have has to do with prediction of future dangerousness, and I've testified in capital cases before. Eric's was the first case I had actually contracted to participate in, and as I say, I did not have to testify at that time.
Did you talk to Eric during this process?
Certainly. I interviewed Eric during his time while he was in Harris County Jail. I've continued to correspond with Eric after his incarceration, and came and actually visited him a couple of times after he received his execution date. So I've kept in touch with Eric. I know all about the crime. I know there's no question about the horror and the brutality and the complete disregard for human life that was represented by his horrible action. And so I'm sympathetic to that issue. I know that he's portrayed in the media as a monster. He certainly considers himself to have been one during the period of time when he committed the crime that he committed. He's a person that he's changed.
Does he have any rationale for how he got in that state and how he is no longer in that state?
Well, at the time of his trial, there was evidence that was presented to the jury that shows that he has some kind of brain dysfunction in his prefrontal lobe, which is the area of our brain that governs and modifies impulse control. And so at the time of his trial, that evidence was introduced to the jury during his sentencing phase. It was not enough to convince them that there should be any mitigation concerning his culpability and ultimate sentence, and so the jury still gave him the death penalty. They did hear that evidence. Unfortunately, after the trial and after his sentence, several years after his trial and sentence, a new body of research unfolded that identified that not only did Eric have this prefrontal problem, but he also had been exposed to some serious toxic chemicals while he was serving in the military, and he was in the Navy, and those chemicals, just exposure to those chemicals themselves, often results in a loss of impulse control. And so there is concern that if a jury had heard about that, they might have been a little bit more sympathetic during the sentencing phase and been more likely to sentence him to life in prison rather than execution.
Is all this an evolving science? I mean, this changes science, even today?
Science, as a discipline, is always evolving. We always learn new things, and unfortunately, when we're using the science in a legal context, sometimes what we learn a year later is too late because the jury can't consider it, and that new information is very, very difficult to get introduced during an appellate review, because almost all of the appellate situations have to rely on information that was presented during the trial.
Mercy, I certainly don't envy your position tonight, Professor Longmire, and I appreciate your sharing some thoughts with the audience here on Texas Execution Watch.
There's one more point I want to make, Ray, which, as I've said, one of the things that troubles me most about this case, about Eric's case, is time. My guess is that if Eric Nenna were being tried today for exactly the same crime, given what we know about the conditions of his illness, but also the jury today would have been able to hear that when Eric gets a sentence to life in prison, he will be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And someone like Eric, at the time he was, I think, 33 years old or so, the likelihood of him being released at that time, he would have to have spent 40 years before becoming eligible for parole. But even then, the jury couldn't hear that. That testimony was not allowed to be given. At that time, in fact, state law prohibited the jury from considering issues around parole eligibility during their deliberations. And so today the law has changed, and today I think there would be a little bit more concern, perhaps a little bit more compassion for the situation Eric is in.
And some of his injuries are a product of his service in the U.S. military, right?
Absolutely. That's why today it would be more salient, because today we have a very sympathetic concern about military. We know a lot more about things like post-traumatic stress, but even more, in Eric's case, we're talking about his having been exposed to toxic chemicals while he was just doing his job. They weren't weaponry, it was literally toxic chemicals associated with cleaning furnaces, the furnaces and the operational unit of a Navy vessel. And if something like that contributed to the impulse control losses that are associated with this kind of a crime, I think the jury should be at least knowledgeable about it, and I would hope that they would have it in their hearts to be able to say, he's a monster, but not responsible for it. Maybe spare his life.
Well, I'm sure you're going to be joining us on future programs on Texas Execution Watch, and we're going to ask your post-experience impressions of witnessing this execution.
Okay, well, keep up your good work, and thank you for the call.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was a taped interview with Dennis Longmire that we did before the execution. He'll be back on future shows. Jim, you heard what he had to say. Any observations?
Now, the problem with is the vehicle of getting that evidence in front of a jury. There's your problem. I'll tell you why. First off, we have tried to get in evidence to show that people have diminished capacity to form a culpable mental state. Let me explain what that gibberish means. To be a criminal, you got to do two things. You got to have a bad act and a bad mind. For example, if I'm at a football game and jump up because something wonderful happened to hit you, that's a bad act. But I don't have an intent, a bad mind, therefore it's not criminal. And so we've tried to get in evidence about people having diminished capacity to form a culpable mental state because of mental defects or because of on maybe service-related injuries, much like this guy, perhaps. But that's not admissible because under our laws, either you're insane or you're not insane. It's not going to come into evidence during guilt or innocence because either you're crazy under the law or you're not crazy, meaning if you know what you're doing is right and wrong, they don't really give a damn if you have diminished mental capacity. They never permitted that evidence in.
Is it true that Texas actually has a higher culpability standard?
No, it's about the same everywhere. Because we have four culpable mental states intentionally doing it, knowingly doing it, recklessly doing it, negligently doing it. And that's pretty well, standard across the board. And then you can't get it in at punishment. Well, you could, I suppose. But the problem is, as I said before, if you get this sort of evidence in at punishment, it's also an incentive. It cuts two ways. Because if someone is defective, and I've said this numerous times before, it's incentive on the part of the jury to execute because they can't be fixed. And I think you made a better point back in those days when he was tried. You could argue, at least somewhat effectively, that he wouldn't be a danger in prison because there's no 6-year-olds running around because the only dangers were from 6-year-olds. Mm-hmm. That may be the better approach. Frankly, the way most people react, anytime they hear evidence of a little 7-year-old girl being abducted and choked and then killed and someone having sex afterward, they're going to kill him. I don't give a damn what. And that's most jurors are going to do that.
That's pretty knee-jerk stuff.
And see, where my problem is with cases like this is that we have never as a society accepted the fact that some people are pedophiles and need to have some type of intervention prior to the time that they get out of control. And we've never been very open about that. Let me give you an example. In my little hometown, we didn't have pedophiles. I mean, we were too small to have one. We had a Baptist preacher's son who used to have carnal knowledge with chickens, but his name was Bobby Gamble.
The chickens never complained.
The chickens never snitched him off.
Those
and he had his way. No, they were bad chickens, but he had carnal knowledge with chickens. It's my only experience ever with any guy messing with something unusual. In fact, he died about 2 years ago, and my brother and I started to go up to the funeral, stick a chicken in the casket. The hell would give him a bond voyage. I didn't know anything about pedophiles until years ago. I started representing a man who was in his 50s, and he told me his whole history. He said, "I hate myself for feeling this way, but there's no place I can go to get help." He said, "If I was a drunk or a drug addict, I could go somewhere, but I go to some group and tell them I want to have sex with small children, like 6-year-old or 7-year-olds, they start shunning me. And there's no place he could go to get help." And thank God, a guy named Jerome B. Brown has started a treatment center for pedophiles here in town. And I think we ought to be more open about that. For example, remember the big controversy Mike McSpadden got into when they had the pedophile who wanted to voluntarily castrate himself? Well, everybody thought
that was violated his parole incident.
Well, what was interesting about that, when that first hit, I was kind of flabbergasted, and I began to read, and that is a very common practice in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had, because one of the real problems, you can't still kill a sex drive until you get real old, especially with men. Men are on their dying grave, will try to pork something, how they are. And so you're not going to kill the sex, you got to do something to curb the sex drive. And in Europe, they've used voluntary castration quite often. We've never discussed that very openly here. And we're not very open in our society about giving treatment for people who are pedophiles. And it's a shame, because had there been something available back when Nino first got in trouble, had there been some place that he could have been... because he said himself he didn't like the way he felt about children. He didn't like that. And this client I had who was a pedophile said, "I hate myself, but where do I go to get treatment? How do I cope with this?" Because you think about it, if your normal sex drive puts you in jail, either you're going to do something to learn to live with it or do something to diminish your sex drive. And I think our society should be at least a little bit more open-minded and try to have some type of dialogue about
it. Maybe my experience is different. Because I talk to a fellow regularly.
You never had admitted a good chicken, maybe. Go ahead.
Well, no. If I had not done the organizing and movement stuff I did for gay and lesbian people in the 60s and mm-hmm. 70s and the 80s, we as a class of people would be bunched in with the sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have to register, and we couldn't move, and all that. That we missed that, dodged that bullet, was not an incidental thing. It was something done on purpose as a class of people, and we became too politically significant to suffer that kind of degradation and control. So I look at that through that lens.
You see, the difference, Ray, with the homosexual activity, those are between consenting adults.
I know.
It's not between the child.
I know, but
that's a problem.
If you go back to the mental set of the 50s and the 60s,
right,
then that was not enough difference. Because I remember at one time California had laws, and they advertised and gave publication, "For your own safety, go register." And then once you registered, you couldn't move without prior information. So they actually mm-hmm. had a queer registration program going on in California in the late 50s. And that's one of the things that I struggled against in the early 60s was registration laws and criminalization laws and those kind of things. But we missed that bullet simply because we organized and became too politically significant to be treated that way. Now, the people that I know that are pedophiles tell me, "I'm a compulsive pedophile."
Right.
"And this is what I do to stay out of trouble." I mean, they make no bones about it. I mean, of course, they since I'm the guy from the gay community, then talking about sex with me is easier to do than talking to people that are not in that same kind of mental state to me. But I'm sometimes shocked. And sometimes alarmed, and sometimes I worry about somebody telling me that I'm a compulsive pedophile and I control it this way. Because I do know a lot about chemical addiction and other addictive problems, and although I stop short from saying sex can be an addiction, compulsive behavior can be compulsive behavior. And that can go across a broad range of topics. This man's dead.
All right.
He paid the ultimate price for what apparently was a horrible, unconscionable act. He kidnapped, killed, and then raped a 7-year-old girl in his neighborhood. A terrible thing. He has been punished as much as we can punish anybody. And today we've been talking about Eric Charles Neno, who has now been executed by the state of Texas about a little over half an hour ago. And our next show, there's another execution on Thursday. And Gregory Wright is the person that's scheduled to be executed. We will be here at 6 p.m. Details are already posted on executionwatch.org. And the name of this program is Execution Watch. If the execution is canceled, there will be no show. If there is a show, that means that, and we've had this happen. We've started a show, and the execution was canceled, and we continue the show as kind of a breaking news story. Tune in and listen up. You can get to this program on executionwatch.org. You can get to this program on theprisonshow.org. You can get to this program on kpft.org. Our technical wizard is Otis McClay, who's got to get out. Jim Skelton is the attorney that's frequently in the studio. He's a regular member of our staff. We had tonight Professor Dennis Longmire from Sam Houston State University. We had Gloria Ruback of the annual March to Stop Executions that happened last Saturday. And we had Nancy Bailey of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty and Amnesty International Houston Chapter. Our producer, of course, is Elizabeth Stein. And we thank all of the staff, producer, and the guests for tonight's show. I hope not to see you Thursday night. But if necessary, I will be here. I am Ray Hill. This is KPFT Houston.
I was fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town. Left to be all I could be, come on.